KB2YTT returning. Yes, it doesn't have any power at all. It works off a prism. The light comes in on the one piece of fiber and hits the glass, and it gets separated into those 32 ports. So there is no type of power up on the box on the pole. The only power you've got, you know, is on the ONT at the house that uses the, I guess it really runs on 12 volts, and that's why they put the battery pack in the house there, in case you have a power outage. If you're on the phone continuously, it will probably last you 6 to 8 hours, but if you use it sporadically, you'll probably get a whole week if you never had any power, at least on the phone portion. Back to you.
Okay, that answers a major question that I've worried about for quite a while, because I know regular landline phones, the power of the phone, I know they sometimes go through CEVs, but they have huge batteries standing on those complexes in the ground. But years ago, when I was in the subway and back to the central office, you had a connection from you back to the CO, and they have huge batteries in there, so you didn't have to worry about it during a power outage. You never ran out of phone electric to run the phones, where sometimes these systems like opt online, things like that, it makes you wonder how long this stuff can operate when you have a power outage, because if you got your phone on your cable, you're kind of out the creek when the power goes out.
I've got a question here, Bill.
I don't know whether I got this here, but to answer your question, I know you said they could either use cap or use coaxial to feed each computer or television in the house. They could do it either. They could do it either way. Mine's wired with Cat 5, but they could have easily have done it with the coax that's here too.
The question I've got for you, Bill, is that you've got a fiber cable coming from the central office, which is going to go to a prism mechanism that breaks it up into 32 individual fibers for the 32 homes. Does that prism break it up by simple power divide, or is it a frequency divide? In other words, is there a slightly different wavelength going to each of those 32 homes after that prism? Over to you, Bill.
From what I've been told, it's not. It has nothing to do with that. It's actually you get the same signal at all 32 homes. It's just the information that's put into the ONT on the outside of the house and put into the computers in the central office. That see to it that it gets addressed to the right place.
Okay, if that particular cable is feeding 32 homes, and house number 3 is now requesting a pay-per-view movie, how do you route that movie to only house number 3 and not the other 31 houses? Over to you, Bill.
As far as I know, it's all done. It's like password protecting. You know your computer terminal, your network, what you got on the network, and it sees that house number 4 is asking for this movie, and it knows that house number 4 has such a code on it, and it sends it out. It will send the movie out and direct it to that ONT that has that certain code. Now, one thing you gotta, those ONTs are addressed to that one slot of 32. Like if someone moved your fiber optic jumper in there to another group of 32, you'd lose everything. You gotta stay within that group of 32 there. But they're all addressed. Those 32 ONTs all have a different number assigned to it, and there's no difference in signal. You would have to physically move like that ONT off one house and put it on another to change that around.
Dick, think of it like an IP address. That's the impression I'm getting. Okay, so my ONT has a particular IP address, and now because I've requested, I'm in house number 4, and of the 32 houses, and I've requested a particular pay-per-view movie, I am guessing that a command is sent down that cable. Oh, no. I was about to say a command is sent to enable that reception of the pay-per-view movie into my house. I see what's going on now. When you package that movie, that pay-per-view movie, back at the central office, it is given the address of my particular ONT. Therefore, in theory, only my ONT can demodulate it. Am I getting close to right here, Bill? Go ahead.
You're right on the money.
Okay, we're slowly getting smarter here. Boy, I think fiber and computers and digital logic and digital TV, I think these things are going to catch on. Hey, Glenn, Mr. QIQ, go right ahead with your question or comment, K2LIW.
Dick, one real quick thing.
Yeah, go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, the nice thing about Fios is they don't send video down the cable. It's actually all IP traffic, okay, and it's reconstructed by the box, by the TV set. The way I get my pictures from Long Island to New York, from WNET to WLIW, is via a gigabit Ethernet cable. I essentially take the video, I make my form of MPEG-2 out of it, I run it at the particular bit rate that makes me happy, which for the standard stuff, I run about 18 megabit. It goes down this cable, which is actually a private network cable, which feeds all the New York State public television stations, so we can share materials and files. And it all happens in computer land. It's no longer video land. Essentially, that's what's happening with more all of the newer technologies in cable distribution and fiber optic distribution. And that's the general method. Whereas the WDM comes into play for Fios, for example, is to give you the baseline of the RF stuff that you can get straight into your TV set.
Far out. Fantastic. Okay. I think advanced television, ATS, advanced television system, and digital television, I suspect it's going to catch on. Particularly up to and including and after February 17th, 2009. KC2QIQ, you got it, Glenn. K2LIW.
WS Glenn with comments.
Paul recognized. Glenn first.
Yeah, sure. I'm just listening to what's going on, and it sounds to me like there's still a little misconception about what's going on with the light and how it's being transmitted and where the digital is taking place. On the transmitting end, there is digital, but it's a very, very high-speed digital router, and that's like 1.5 gig. That's a huge router with a tremendous amount of digital information being fed by a large server control. Then it goes into a light modem. Now, at that point, is that really is digital information being modulated on top of three separate bandwidths of analog light? So one is like a phone service network of light. Another one is a video service of light, and the other one is a separate network of light for specifically for internet. Now, once it comes down through the modem on the house side, and it becomes demodulated light back into digital at that point, there is a little RF box on there that is addressable, but the digital that you would get in your computer is basically coming from that VHF signal, which goes directly into your modem box, and then you wind up with your four-pair Cat5 or your 802 wireless connection at the modem. The cable top box is what's addressable for the television channel. It actually has a memory card inside that box. The modem that's actually bringing the light in has to convert to the VHF signal at that point, and it also has to split off into the telephone networking at the house. So there's actually three separate sets of digital decoding going on after the modem producing the light back into the individual modes of networking.
Again, far out. We used to make jokes about DC to light. Now it's DC to gamma ray. Bill, is the OC192 standard, is that the one that's being used to actually transmit the signal on the fiber? And I think that standard has 10 gigabits per second capability. KB2YTT, K2LIW.
Yeah, Dick, I'm not sure what they use on the Fios. I got involved a little in like the boxes and all that. I know when I was working upstate in out of Oneonta there, that they had a long distance leg that was connected to Binghamton, and it I guess it's about 60, 70 miles, and they had two CEVs in between, and I tell you, the fiber cable, it was like one of the first ones ever ran in New York, and it was like a foreign color code when I worked on it, because I'd never seen it before. But I know they used to use all 12 fibers at one time, but well, by the time I left that area up there, they were down to using only two fibers, two separate fibers to carry all that information that they used to, for carrying like four times the information that they used to use all 12 to do. So definitely on those muxes that they got, they keep upping the ante on them, and they're I don't see any limit with them, so they're going to constantly upgrade them, and you know they do it, sometimes they do it by timing the light at different sequences, and sometimes they use different color lights and send them down the fiber. There's a whole thing to it, and I'm not that versed on it. I know a little bit of knowledge is dangerous, you know, but it's a constant, it's constantly upgrading all the time. Back to you.
Okay, awful great. You checked in, Bill, giving us a lot of information that would be quite hard for us to get any other way. And even though you don't feel confident that you're right up to state of the art, you're still giving us a lot of information we didn't previously have. Paul, WS2N, go right ahead with your statement or comment. KQLIW.
Okay, Dick, it sounds similar to an article. I think it was in QST, except they were talking about space wiring. You take a satellite, any spacecraft nowadays that they're putting out, could be communication, could be something going to a different planet. The equipment all on these platforms, the spacecraft, you might have 10 different important pieces of equipment. You might have, say, half a dozen experiments. You might have cameras that have to operate. You might have telescopes that have to change filters or move one way or the other. And what they do now, you know, years ago they used to have one main switching area type of thing on a spacecraft, and dozens of wires going out to each piece of equipment on board the spacecraft to, you know, command it to do this and do that. Nowadays, all they, you know, each piece of equipment all has the power supply connected to it, and it's got a data lead. And the article said, you know, think internet. What they do is they'll send a command, let's say, to the platform that moves the telescopes to go one way or the other, something to fire the engines, you know, a thruster one way or the other. It'll just send a digital signal to that piece of equipment, and then the equipment internally will say, okay, it's my turn to come on, and the signal wants me to do something, and the thruster will fire, or the telescope will move, or something will happen. And, you know, it naturally keeps the weight down, and it keeps a lot of possible failures from occurring. And that's what they're doing. On the spacecraft, it sounds like BIOS has taken it from that development and put it into millions of homes. Back to you, Dick. WS1.
Along those lines, Paul, I'm a member of ASLI, Astronomical Society of Long Island, and various members have subscribed to a service which by internet gives you connection to a good-sized telescope on top of a mountain in either Tucson, Arizona, or Phoenix, Arizona. And so during the right period of time, you can command that telescope to go to whatever direction in space you want it to go to, set on whatever lens you want, whatever kind of camera you want, and it'll integrate for the right period of time and take that picture of that celestial object for you. By the same token, the Society of Amateur Radio Astronomers, SARA, when the last I was visiting them quite a few years ago, at one of their yearly meetings at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory in Green Bank, West Virginia, they were taking the dish that was no longer being used by Project Ozma. Frank Drake, way back in the middle 60s, I guess it was, late 60s, had this 85-foot dish constructed, and it was the first search for extraterrestrial intelligence. That dish is no longer being used, and the last I knew, the Sarah people were hooking up automatic system to it so that you could command the dish by a computer network, by your internet connection, to go to whatever direction you want and whatever frequency you want and listen and make a recording. So remote control of devices that require all kinds of bandwidth are coming a long way. Eric, what's your guess? Is the OC192 standard, which is a 10 gigabit per second standard, is the possible optical modem? Or could it be OC384, which I think is good for 40 gigabits? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
K2LIW, KE2EJ. Well, if you're talking about FIBO subscriber lines, you're not talking anything that fancy, because they do a little light color separation. That gives them a little bit of difference. And I suspect, and I can actually find out, now that you got going, I'll call a guy tomorrow and I'll ask him, but I suspect it's pretty much just straight old IP data running probably, 802.11, 802.1 actually, as far as like the protocol is concerned. But if you're doing 1 gigabit, you have more than enough bandwidth to do everything you want and more. I mean, that's an incredible amount of space. And I'm pretty darn sure that one segment of the light spectrum that is dedicated to analog television service. So that really doesn't take up any data per se. It just takes up light bandwidth. So the boxes that they use where they mix and add, if you go up to Corning, you can actually see what the insides of them look like because they manufacture them. And it's really quite interesting. But that's my guess. I don't think you're going to see something with like OC192 into the subscriber home, because the amount of multiplexing and demultiplexing that you would have to support would be really very expensive. K2RIWK2.
Okay, that makes sense. The actual fiber that goes from my house ultimately to the central office, roughly how many miles of fiber will that system support before some kind of boosting amplifier is required? Back to you, Eric.
Yeah, I suppose Jim Leiser, the gentleman out there, could probably give you a better answer to that. But again, that's another interesting thing, because when you do have to increase the brightness of the light, you just simply pump more energy into it. It's not like you have to decode it and re-encode it, because that would take a lot of electronics. These devices are so purely simple, and they're purely optical. It would be another local laser source, in essence, putting some energy behind the light, and the way they do it is quite weird. It's just, it's one of those unusual characteristics of physics that makes it happen.
Okay, I'm going to ask Bill that one. Hey, Bill, do you have a rough idea how many miles I could go before light boosting is required on the single-mode fiber? And what's the name of that kind of a booster amplifier? They have a very similar problem when it comes to the fiber optic undersea cable that goes between the United States and the United Kingdom, we'll say. I think they do have a kind of optical light boosting amplifier they can put in there, which does not do demod and remod after the amplification, in between the amplification. KB2YTT, K2RIW.
Well, as I know, with the Fios stick, that there was nothing here on Long Island, as far as I know, that where they had to boost anything on. I mean, like, one of our biggest central offices was probably Lynbrook. It went quite a way. I don't know whether you know where the McDonald's is on Merrick Road in Lynbrook. Central office is, like, right behind it. And they used to push the lines all the way down to the borderline of Valley Stream and Queens there, and it was quite a way. In fact, it was so far away that the telephone lines, to get them there copper, they lost so much milliamps that they wound up putting in those slicks, those slick central offices all over the place, you know, and a lot of the phone lines in that area were fed out of those CEVs, those, what do they call them, environmental vaults, and they put them in the ground, or sometimes they were above the ground. But I know with the fires, I would say I'd say you're good for like at least 20 miles or so.
It's kind of obvious that fiber is the way to go. Wire doesn't have enough bandwidth, it's got too much loss. Coax cable definitely has too much loss, not enough bandwidth. So fiber's got a lot of it. I'm getting the impression that many of the American homes in the very near future were going to have fiber to the house to do essentially all of the communication between house and rest of world, whether you're making a phone call to your next-door neighbor. Obviously, it's going to go back to the central office and back, but maybe even somebody may find a way of simplifying that someday. So as we get more and more fiber optic connected, what used to be called broadcast, which I now call narrowcast, cablecast, it would suggest that the future for over-the-air RF broadcast is somewhat limited, and I guess its future 20 years from now is in somewhat of doubt in my mind. Let's see what Eric thinks about that. K2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, you know, a lot of that has to do with economics. And the way the economics are right now, and owning a home and paying your taxes, makes some people not want to spend a little extra money on a little extra stuff. But there was a time that we were walking around without a cell phone, and the phone company made their money on payphones. You know, as the economic climate changes, as technology changes, you know, according to what's happening in our world at that given moment, will have an effect on what happens. There's a lot of really good technologies that are still kind of expensive. So, being where we are, we'll see what happens. I mean, now look at things like Iridium and other things that were really good ideas. A lot of money got put into them, but after a while, trying to pay it back becomes a whole other story. So that's something that's got to get added into the equation. Interestingly enough, we talk about fiber circuits. Williams, which is one of the bigger oil company pipelines, is also one of the largest fiber, long-distance fiber companies for media and other things. They have right-of-ways that run all the way around the country. And we send Charlie Rose down to Washington. I don't think there's one node unit somewhere, and it's like 150 miles away, but it's just a little light amplifier, I believe, is what it is. But it's not one device for every 150 miles, so that can give you an idea. But interestingly, on that circuit, they use a higher power laser rather than a traditional, single frequency LED.
Right now, let's assume now, Bill, that this is Eric. Assume now this is the summer of 2009. We've gone through the transition of 2009, February 17th. Everybody's on digital television, or at least a high percentage of them are on digital television. So therefore, we're basically talking 1 year from today. Make me a rough guess. What percentage of your TV viewers will be watching over-the-air RF broadcast, as opposed to some other, I'm going to call it trunked medium, which means fiber, satellite, or cable, narrowcast. So let me call it narrowcast. What percentage of your TV viewers do you think will be on a narrowcast system as opposed to a broadcast system? K2EJ, K2RIW, asking for a wild-ass guess.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Let me give you one little food for thought kind of thing here. One actual event which WNET was able to actually make a measurement of, or at least get a fairly decent idea of who was watching and who wasn't, was the day the World Trade Center went down. In terms of the response of the number of people that called wondering where their Channel 13 was. And the demographics of it was a higher number than anyone could ever possibly imagine. It came in with somewhere around 40% of people watching over the air. So, you know, let's translate that now. That means that it was on cable. There was that other 60% of people that were on cable or satellite. So there's that issue in there. So you can figure that that 40% probably is still not very computer savvy. I mean, it's So that's one instance. WLIW being more in the suburban area where the affluent is split around differently, I suspect there you're going to find other forms of medium rather than over the air. Since digital television kind of sort of really doesn't work well, but it works, there's going to be a lot of frustration in the switch, because there are a lot of people who have second and third televisions that either on a small antenna in the attic or whatever that is, if they're close enough, because they don't want to buy another cable box every TV set and a half.
KC2QIQ.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, just a quick comment. I was looking at one of my fiber charts for different fiber optic cables, and just to give you an idea of the length and how much signal you can get through a fiber optic cable. A really poor fiber optic cable by today's standards would be, for very short length runs, a few hundred feet or whatever, would be 20 dB per kilometer. And for the really, really long distance runs, like the intercontinental ones, they can be as low as 0.5 dB per kilometer.
Very nice. Half a dB per kilometer. I think you're saying near state-of-the-art cables. So I think I see where you're going here, Eric. A certain percentage of the population doesn't want to buy another or pay for or get a hold of another set-top modem, set-top demodulator box. So that particular set, which is occasionally used in the kitchen by their eating their breakfast in the morning, on rabbit ears, they're on that small set, they're watching the news, and they're watching over-the-air broadcast. So the home itself could have narrowcast capability with a full capability, but a certain number of the sets in the house are still running on rabbit ears or an old-fashioned antenna connected to the roof. And so some of those calls you guys got, I think you said 40% of the population was the estimation, a certain percentage of those already had narrowcast, but wanted to know why the broadcast wasn't working. Did I get that one correctly, Eric? Go ahead.
No, you can pretty much say that the 60% that's just using these numbers got it narrowcast, either cable or satellite. But you know, we have to be more careful about how we define, because we live in the world of YouTube too. So, you know, turning on a computer and going to a site is a little bit different kind of an effort than it is to go over to the TV set, turn on the switch, and just punch up a channel number and switch between them and see what's on. So it's a different experience. It's a different emotional experience, a different psychological experience. It has a different effect on people. That's why the TV in the kitchen, you know, you're watching while you're eating breakfast and you're watching the news, whether it's CNN or, you know, one of the early morning shows that the network provides, it's a different kind of thing rather than having to go over to your laptop or your desktop, or maybe you're a real computer aficionado and you have it on a plasma, but you still have to go to the site, you still have to kind of like, you know, surf to get where you're going.
Fascinating. Will the ratio stay the same, or do you think it's going to slowly switch broadcast versus narrowcast?
Well, we've long since lost the traditional method of television viewing. The biggest thing that has upset that, you would think, would be the internet and all that stuff, but it really ain't. It's TiVo. It's the time shifting. The internet gives you an easy way to microcast, really, in terms of what it is. You go to YouTube, I mean, if you see something from the network, it's an advertisement. You can, in fact, go to, say, ABC's website, where they use an incredible, actually, a very interesting piece of software. I forget the name of the company now. It just slipped my mind. But they wrote this player that essentially splits the stream up into multiple bits. And as you are aware or not, that when you're watching something streamed via IP, not every packet may take the same path, so some packets may come out of order, and it has to get buffered and put back together. Well, they've seemed to have come up with a way of splitting it up so that it deliberately takes a different path than the ability of your slow computer to play really amazing pictures. If you ever want to try it, the ABC.com website, and you can watch any of their prime time shows, and it looks pretty darn good.
I think you're saying it, in general, has higher quality than what I see on YouTube. Is that true?
Yeah, you got to figure YouTube is really just a storage facility. So they don't want files that are very big, you know.
Makes sense. When it comes to storing audio, like, for instance, recording the program you're listening to right now that we're all, we're all being recorded, that's going to appear over amateurradio.tv, what's your guess as to the number of megabytes per hour to get reasonable quality of the audio that we're now generating? Eric, go ahead.
All right. Well, let's think about this. Let's talk about raw data, okay? We're on an FM, now then, FM system. 5 kilohertz worth of deviation. Really, to the best part of the audio spectrum, we got maybe 3 kilohertz of data to deal with. Do you agree?
Yeah, plain old telephone system will sound reasonably good if 3.5 kc of bandwidth is there. I'll easily recognize my grandmother. Go ahead.
Okay, so, how much resolution in terms of the differences in the amplitude do you think we need? A lot or a little?
I think 16 bits would be too much. 8 bits might make it of amplitude resolution.
Okay, that's where I was going to go. So, say 8 bits worth of amplitude resolution. All right. Now, since you want to use a nice round number, so it's 3 kilohertz. All right, let's go with 3.5 kilohertz of bandwidth in terms of frequency response. That's good. We can chop a little off the bottom and just, we'll call it 3.5. Let's multiply it by 2. That gets us 7. Well, conveniently, you could go over to your Windows Media Player or Windows Media Encoder if you should decide to download it, or even your sound recorder, and select 8 bits at 8 kilohertz sampling rate. There you have raw, uncompressed data that's 8 bits big, okay, and each sample happens every 8,000ths of a second. So we have 8,000 samples, 8 bits every second. Alright, so that's, if it's an 8-bit word, that's 8 kilobits. Do you agree?
8,000 samples and an 8-bit word, or if 8 kilo, wait no, 8,000 words, isn't that 64 kilobits per second? Go ahead.
Sorry, used the wrong word. It's 8 kilobytes. B-Y-T-E-S, each byte being an 8-bit word.
Okay, so I think you and I are on the same page. 8 kilobytes, 64 kilobits per second is the rate at which we record data, and we can easily calculate how many seconds there are in an hour. Therefore, we know how much hard disk drive is going to take up per hour. This program runs 4 hours, so we're trying to figure out what percentage of a hard drive with no audio compression would be taken. My guess is there are some beautiful MPEG audio compression techniques that can save us by, what, about 4 to 1? Go ahead.
Yeah, now you've made me take my calculator out. Okay. So there's, there's 8,000 samples a second, and there's 60 seconds in a minute. 60. And to get an hour, we're going to multiply by another 60 of those. And to get a day, we need 24 hours. So if it was a day, we would need 691 megabytes of data.
And by modern day standards of a hard drive, what percentage of the hard drive is that taking up?
Well, let's see. The average hard drive starts around 60 gigs these days, so, that would be about 10 days worth of recording.
So the hard drive will take 10 days of recording with no compression, and we're only using one-sixth of a day, 4 hours for this particular program. We start 8 o'clock, we end at midnight. We seem to be doing that religiously. There's a couple of puns there somewhere. Okay, so 6 days with a recording is what I think you said, 6 or 8 days with a recording, if we did it 24 hours a day. Yep. Are there audio compression techniques that could then be applied? Would they save me roughly 4 to 1? Would the quality audio sound about the same, or would I know immediately it's being compressed? Back to you, Eric.
Hi. Well, there's a number of different approaches we could take to this. Right. If we really ought to start off by talking about high-quality sound as opposed to low-quality sound, because this is low-quality sound. And with low-quality sound, there's a lot of tricks that don't work as well as they do if you're dealing with high-quality sound. But let's talk about the ways you can compress stuff. Right. There's a very simple method of compression called run-length encoding. And what that essentially means is that for each sample, right, since we've broken it up into 8 or 16 or, in my case, 24 different levels, right, and we can look at the next sample, and we can say that either the sample, actually in this case, this next sample, because it's a low frequency, the amplitude level of that number, let's say it's a 128, and the next sample is 128, well, I have two samples that are taking up two spaces. Okay, and if it's a really low frequency, then I might have six samples in a row that are at 128. So rather than take up six slots, I might say, okay, my first byte of data says how many slots it is, and the next byte is the sample. So in run-length encoding, when you have stuff that is pretty constant, okay, you can reduce a lot of storage space by using this simple method of saying that I have six samples of this value, or I have one sample of that value, and when you put enough of those together, you can get a pretty good reduction in data. That's one very simple method called run-length encoding.
I see how that works. Could the next step on that be a kind of delta encoding? I don't have to have full resolution as to the very next bit of data, because I'm already using Nyquist double sampling. The amount of motion from one sample to the next is kind of small, so I don't need all 8 bits of resolution to describe the very next bit, because in general I'm not transmitting spikes. I'm transmitting smooth audio. So is there a way I can now add a kind of delta modulation on this and limit the data stream? Go ahead.
All right. Ask your question, because I'm going to have a long answer.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Just a quick thing to add to that. One of the common things used to reduce the problem that you're talking about is codec programs, where basically they look at the information over time and sample, and the program actually reassembles the data afterwards, so it gives you a form of compression in itself.
That's pretty good. Eric?
Okay. Let's go another step now. By the way, run-length encoding is really more useful in pictures, because you'll have pixels that'll be white. It happens more often in visual images than it does in oral images. But in low sample rate recordings, where everything tends to be low frequency, run-length encoding is worthwhile. There is another type of compression which relies on the human hearing, and you'll see a lot of that. There's a lot of this stuff which is called psychoacoustical compression, which is actually a compilation of a lot of ideas and other forms of compression behind it. And basically what that says is that the human ear has only a certain amount of, let's call it dynamic range within small areas, whereas you may have a loud drum going boom, 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 and a very tiny little faint triangle going on in the background that nobody in their mind can really hear. Well, the algorithm basically says you can't hear that, so I'm not putting that stuff in. That's what you get on your DVDs, by the way. It's AC3. That's one of the things that Mr. Dolby spent a lot of his life figuring out, which is really cool, actually, when it comes down to it. We can also do compression by doing mathematical representation, which is what the other gentleman's really talking about. And we do it by using a little bit of calculus. Since from the very early times of Mr. Newton and his ideas of how to mathematically represent things in nature, this is basically what we're doing. This whole concept of sampling and everything comes from way back. Anyway, we can do something called quantization. We can make decisions about where the steps themselves actually occur. Right? And we can also do something, is take a group of samples and represent that group of samples by using an algorithm that creates, in the end, a coefficient. And we can send those coefficients, which are representative of groups of samples, based on the samples behind them, the samples that are in the future, and the samples that happened a while ago. Back to you, Dick.
Fantastic. Out of curiosity, Eric, you're very strong at my QTH tonight. You at the salt mine or the home QTH?
No, I'm home. I'm in the middle of building some things. But I moved all my stuff home because I had to shrink the place.
Huh. You're telling me the next time I visit you, I'm not going to recognize things? Is that what you're telling me?
Yeah, actually, we've... the trailers will be gone probably next week. That's gone. So the first phase is happening. We send a lot of people into the city so that way they won't hang around. And the next step is to build a new building.
Fantastic. Roughly how many square feet and what's the anticipated date of completion?
Well, that all depends. Although the grant money is there only for a limited period of time, but... you know, it's not up to us. It's all being taken care of by the lawyers.
Sounds like fun. And one of the definitions of intelligence is the ability to adapt to a new environment. Sounds to me like you're doing a lot of adapting, Eric.
Yeah, I've taken my mess from one place, made it nice and clean, and now I'm messing the other place.
That's the problem I've got. Every so often, somebody wants to hand me something free of charge, which is a very valuable item. And I say to myself, okay, my house is almost full. Where am I going to put it? So I have to decide what I'm going to give up so I can fit it in my house. You know that the Mount Airy VHF Society calls themselves pack rats. Serious ham radio operators collect things. And a philosopher I know used to say that the process of living is the process of collecting things. Eventually, they come and collect you. Okay. Hey, we probably ought to get to the mailbag, because you've been promising we're going to get to it earlier, Mel. K2KEY, what kind of mail have you gotten this week?
Last comment.
Go ahead, Eric.
You know, that when I was at WNET, they used to make me move my office every 2 years, because they would see the stuff just grow. And they'd say, oh, everybody's got to move. So at least I'd wind up with a clean space for a month or so.
Yeah, each of the companies I've worked for do that periodically. Move people for no good reason. And watch them throw things out. And I'm the guy that would look at the stuff they throw out and say, gee, that's valuable. I'm going to take it home. I've collected an awful lot of what I think was good stuff that way. Mel, how was the mail this week? K2LIW.
Roger. This is K2KEY. Well, that's why I stopped that accumulating... to a great extent when I retired. I'm downsizing little by little. Every winter I go through more stuff and get rid of more stuff. It's getting to that point where I'm, you know, my age is saying something. So that thing is to cut the inventory, as they say. I'm looking through what I can read here. A lot of criticisms, Chief. Boy, oh boy, I started reading through them and got distracted and trying to find stuff that I could read, Dick. Tell you, it's a heck of a lot of criticism that I don't know what to do with this stuff over.
Well, let me ask you this, Mel. We're supplying a service. We supply it free of charge. They can't complain about the economy of what they're getting. But is there a common denominator to the criticism? Like, hey, RIW is much too long-winded. Is there a common denominator of that? And I'll plead guilty to that one. Or does each individual guy has his own individual complaint? What's your tilt on that one, Mel?
Well, I hate to have gotten into this. This is K2KEY. The major complaint is here that we spend only very small amount of the time on the TechNet on actual amateur radio because they noticed that I'm way behind on I've been trying to, you know, do the answering of a lot of questions whenever I can, especially for the young people on ham radio. But the criticism seems to be that we take up most of the time, and the only time we do spend on ham radio is on the emails, Dick, over.
Well, the word ham radio nowadays is an extremely broadband hobby. Almost every progressive ham is hooking up computers. He's using computers for digital signal processing. He's using them for control. We're talking about digitally defined radios. There's a lot of wireless to it, without a doubt. You and I do a fair amount of discussion of antennas, feed lines, propagation.
Friends.
So how do you judge what is and what isn't ham radio? Ham radio operators, some of them are aeronautical, some of them are into astronomy. I get an awful lot of positive feedback from the astronomy portions. And when we discuss a search for extraterrestrial intelligence, which is a very advanced kind of ham radio, in my mind, you get a lot of positive feedback on that. Part of what's going on here, Eric, is you can't please all the people all the time. There could be a significant portion of the audience out there that's moderately happy, not complaining, and not writing any emails. And we don't hear from them. We only hear from the more disgruntled people. So it's not so easy to judge by the percentage of emails you get that seem to be a complaint versus whether or not we're serving a purpose. And on top of that, you and I are adaptable. We can adjust. Maybe we can squeeze in more ham radio and a little bit less of something else. Vary and see how people like it. Try not to be discouraged by it, Eric. Whenever you've got a reasonably wide audience, you're going to have disgruntled people. In broadcast, I guarantee they get a lot of disgruntled people, with one exception. Public broadcasting system has a very different kind of material, and therefore they get no complaints, whereas regular broadcasting gets a lot of complaints. Isn't that approximately true, Eric? KE2EJ, KQRAW?
What do you mean by no complaints?
Okay. What's the most common complaint that you get?
Technically, they can't pick us up, doesn't have sound. Usually a cable company that's got the problem. Like the other night, what we were doing. Doing something live. It was an interesting show, too. And in a couple of places on the island, Cablevision had problems that they had, and they had picture but no sound. A lot of people called up and complained. As far as content goes, it depends where you are in the country. Being New York and being one of the most liberal TV stations and also being in a rather liberal neighborhood, they get very, 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 very few complaints about content. Go into the South and go into the West, and it's a very different story because WNET, WRIW produces a lot of the stuff that winds up on the network, and it reflects the thinking and the values of this locale, and it sometimes doesn't play well in other places.
Okay, so I think in the beginning, where you had a mixed cast in Sesame Street, where you occasionally had productions that had, oh, not quite frontal nudity, but something close to it, my guess is the metro areas had no problem with it, whereas some of the southern and central United States areas probably thought it was inappropriate. Is that approximately true?
Okay, a lot of that has to do with who's sitting on the FCC board. It just so happens the last 8 years of the FCC has been a very bad time. By the way, the court just slapped them in the face about the wardrobe fines, you know, the wardrobe malfunction fines. The court struck that down and says, you know, and they're very inconsistent. In the earlier generation of FCC commissioners, because of the famous seven dirty words that George Collins did a whole record about, it was looked at on a case-by-case basis, where there'll be a nature show where we go into the jungle and show people as they naturally are, and there will be breasts on this particular tribe where they're not covered up. Does that violate the rule? Usually we don't have a problem with that. Although the last 8 years has been a very touchy situation, when he does a drop second. But if you remember, there was a Letters from Buster, which is from a cartoon show called Arthur, where there was a segment about my two mommies. And blah, 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 and even some of the public television stations around the country were afraid to show it, where, you know, of course, the New Yorkers and the Bostonians and the D.C. folks had no problem with it. But it just shows you the sensitivity of the way people are and their moral values and how it all gets reflected. The last 8 years has been very hard, whereas you know that even many ABC stations did not want to play Saving Private Ryan. So, now let's see what the next 8 years brings us.
PBS has a program called In the Life, which I'm sure shows in a lot of metro areas. Are there areas in the country which cannot tolerate that particular program?
Well, you have to understand that we're all members of a club, so to speak. PBS stations pay PBS for their content, and you get to pick and choose the content that you want to program on your station. You're not required to... Well, you actually are required to put certain programs that you buy on in their, you know, their national time slot, but you're not required to buy them if you don't want to buy them. So, there's a lot of customizing. It's not uniform throughout the entire network. And actually, many of the shows are put on at multiple time slots so that it can fit your particular schedule.
Okay, I'm getting an impression here of something that I didn't know. Say, for instance, I'm really in love with the programs that I can see on Channel 21 and Channel 13 because I've lived in New York City for a whole lot of years. And for whatever reason, I get moved into central Mississippi, and I start watching a PBS program. I start watching the PBS channel. I think you're saying that much of the content that I used to watch might not be there. Am I approximately right?
Well, I wouldn't say much of the content. Some of the content that you used to watch will be missing. Some. Not all of it. You'll still see the news hour. You'll still see nature. You'll still see great performances. You'll still see... Nova. Those shows you're going to see. It's the other documentaries, the other more intellectual point of views that don't necessarily present themselves broadly to a uniform audience. Those things you might be missing.
I visited a relative who was living in Mississippi 20 years ago. Maybe it was 30 years ago. I was amazed that the whole state of Mississippi at that time would not allow Sesame Street, and I think Contact 123 also, but I know Sesame Street was not allowed to be shown in that state. Was I being misinformed, or is that approximately accurate 30 years ago?
2HWW, requesting please on this matter.
Okay, we'll get you in a second. Go ahead, Eric.
Actually, you are right about that. Interestingly enough, Mississippi public television has become a very, very interesting organization and very much in the forefront of content these days, but they still, they put up a lot of fight amongst their own legislative people, and it's interesting. You look into it, they have an interesting take on how they behave.
Go ahead, Howie.
WW with a question, please.
Yeah, you got the floor, Howie.
People can't get in. This question is for Eric. It's somewhat on this subject. Eric, are you familiar with something called WatchTV.com, FreeTV.com? There's some of these programs out now that allow you to watch all kinds of TV streams all around the world. Do you have any comment on that as far as PBS is concerned?
Well, I don't speak for PBS, Howie, but there's been a lot of things that have happened with a number of those different services. Some of them have gotten sued because it's still you're still dealing with copyright. There was one, I think that was based in London, but it got shut down, and it had stuff from all over the world. And basically, they were stealing it and putting it on a website. So, you know, that's what happened.
I think this program is called WatchFreeTV.com, and I think what it does is a program that goes out and finds the streams for you. They're not streaming it. It finds the streams. It seems like almost every radio station or every TV station is streaming. Isn't PBS streaming its program on the Internet?
You will find that most of the networks do not do real-time streaming, except for certain things, but it'll be near-time streaming. But usually it's mostly store and forward, so you can go to their websites and you can get whatever you want out of them for the most part. So, but it, you know, the more people look at your stuff, the better, because every bit of that is measured, and that adds up to your advertising dollars, so nobody usually objects to it. And if you're talking about, oh, I know, you're talking about the search engine that finds stuff for you, which that's fine. That's a good thing. That means the broadcaster is putting it there in the first place. They want people to see it.
So, you know, I haven't got the program yet, but I'm thinking about paying $49 for it. They've been advertised. It's called WatchFreeTV.com. FreeTV.com. It's a program. It's $49, and they say you can get hundreds and hundreds and thousands of radio stations, more than you can get off of satellite or cable TV. And they've been advertising, especially on ABC, and it's $49.95, one-time fee. You get the software, you load it on your computer, and then you can watch all kinds of stuff. Over to you, Dick.
It's not quite free. XM and the other audio satellite service, why can't I think of them, have, I think, just agreed to merge. How soon is that going to take place, if anyone knows?
The FCC is dragging their feet.
Okay, so a partial decision has been made, but it's not all the votes haven't been counted yet. Is that what you're saying, Eric?
FCC approved it Friday night. The FCC voted. They said okay.
When was it?
Friday night. It was on the news. Friday night, the FCC gave the go-ahead. All the commissions agreed. They got to keep their pricing license for the next 2 years or 3 years. They have certain conditions, but the FCC gave their blessing.
It's about time now. Neither one of them can go broke. Well, they'll go broke together.
Are you predicting, Eric, that that service will be economically viable? Even with Howard Stern?
Probably too far. These two companies' models weren't going to work. So what were they going to do? Let the satellites go out of orbit, or let them go off the air like they did with the other service, the telephone service that Motorola was involved in? So the FCC had no choice.
By the way, Iridium is active, it just has a different name.
Yeah, almost go bankrupt where the satellites were left alone for a while.
Isn't Iridium being used by military?
No, it's another commercial organization. It's actually a satellite phone with specialized benefits. They compete with Marisat, and actually it's turning profitable. It's all about marketing, you know? I mean, the system works. And the phones in the beginning were big and clunky, but if you look at what they've come out with now, it's just not bad.
Okay, we got to get back to Mel. And Mel, try not to be discouraged. You're going to get a certain percentage of complaints, but I think there's a certain percentage of people that I'm hearing from time to time that are relatively pleased. And we all have a great big dial in the front of the rig. You don't have to listen to this particular channel. You can dial some other channel. And the price is right. It's free. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger, this is K2KEY. I'm just saying the majority of my emails, this has been going on now, starting to get really overwhelming, are criticism. And the criticism, I'm just trying to boil it down, I was just reading a number of them. And they said, it has nothing to do with ham radio, most of this stuff. Or you mentioned one, you said, Dick always mentions 24 different types of ham radio operators. You guys don't even discuss more than two a night if we're lucky. I don't know. I can say I don't know what to do with this stuff, Dick. It's up to you. It's your net, you know, and I'm just the person that is reading the email, I guess, just the messenger, over.
Okay, I'm going to take exception with at least one of those statements, Mel. If you go to amateurradio.tv, and you choose the four reels that represent the 4 hours of any one night, and you use that website correctly, where Mike has broken it down to every couple of minutes what subject is being discussed, and you look at that list of subjects that's in that four-hour period, man, that covers a lot of territory. And even if only 25% of it was absolutely traditional, down-the-middle ham radio, that is an hour's worth of ham radio. Now, a person who doesn't want to sift through 4 hours of us rambling on all of our favorite hobby subjects and only wants the ham radio subjects, he can go to that index. He can look at what reel number, what minute into that reel number discusses that particular ham radio subject. He can pick and choose and listen to only those particular subjects that are all documented. He doesn't have to listen to any of the rest of the stuff if that offends him. So when you go to one of those index lists that are on that website, do that sometime and just look at all the subjects we discuss. There's a lot of subjects in there. It amazes me. I don't remember it all. K2KUY, K2LAW.